That's, oh my God. I'm just even thinking about the fact that the product exists right now and then all of the different applications and use cases. Back when my hair was longer in college, I could have definitely used that. So that would have been
Listen, I see you
appreciated.
growing out that beard, and we're testing on men to do their
Really?
beards. We are.
All right,
Yeah.
well, sign
Yeah,
me up.
you can
I'm
get
here
me
with
a, you know,
it.
you can, yeah, man.
Guys, welcome back to another episode of Why Y'all Working. We have a new guest this week. Dawn Myers from Ritualist. We'll be talking about her and her company later on this show. I'm one of your hosts, Alaire Jameson. We also have
Michael Ogusanya.
And you know that we have a jam-packed episode for you whenever we have a great guest that's able to talk about many different things from a really diverse background, celebrates a lot, has been with us on our TechStars journey as well. So we'd love to, have her here with us today. And we'd love to get into our first segment, just talking about her background and where Ritualist came to be and how it's kind of grown to be the big behemoth that it is today. So we appreciate you, Dawn. Thank you so much for joining us on our episode this morning, or this afternoon, rather. And love to chat a little bit more.
Looking forward, first of all, Behemoth, you're definitely giving me some big shoes to grow into, but I'm gonna take it. I receive it. Thank
You're
you guys
already in those
for
shoes.
that. Oh, very kind. Thank you guys for having me. This is gonna be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. So, if we haven't shared before, again, Dawn Myers focused on CPG, consumer product goods, for those that don't know. How can you take the millions, the over 350 million citizens of America, the over 8 billion people that live in the world, and give them products that relate to their everyday consumer experience? So Dawn Myers is a 2022 TechStars alum, 2022, 2023 TechStars Equitech alum, that was able to pitch her business focused on providing an experience, providing, you're almost providing by subtracting. So for the people that have to spend hours getting ready every day, getting their hair done, even the night before, you've created a product that people can cut the hair process, the hair time to do your hair in about half in order for them to have one, the right conditioning, the right natural hairs within their hair. So it's not falling out. There's no issues at all there, but also
Yes.
have it be stylish and something that makes them proud to be, the many different and diverse perspectives and backgrounds that we have in this country and in this world today. So again, starting your company through a very rough time in the world during the pandemic, scaling it up, raising over $500,000 in venture funding, including recently just raising about half of your $1 million round. Dawn Myers is well on her way to becoming a behemoth, as we used in providing people the needs that they providing people the products that they need. So
Yeah.
let's
First of all, let me say, I was holding my breath because whenever a man tries to pitch my company, it does not go well. But you did beautifully. You did beautifully. That's exactly
Thank
right.
you.
We are a brand, a family of brands, actually. I have a kind of shell company that hosts multiple brands. Right now, we're focused on Ritualist, but the kind of running theme is tech-enabled hardware, right? So we've got lots of liquid product brands in the space, which I think is beautiful, right? When I kind of went natural, this was probably 15, 18 years ago, we didn't have any of that, right? I was using olive oil from the grocery store and aloe that you used to use when you get sunburns. That was literally my hair regimen. But now we have these beautiful products, and it's a big deal. But we don't have the tech that makes it easier, that makes the process take less time, all the pain points that you referenced, Michael. So that's what we're focused on. And there's a big barrier to entry in the space, right? The number of Black women, the number of Black people, but Black women in particular, in the tech-enabled hardware space is minuscule, minuscule. You can literally count us on two hands. And I know this because we're all in a group chat. There are literally a handful of us. And here's the thing, this space is very hard. You'll hear investors say all the time, hardware is hard. And it's true. But it is on the other side of that hard is a near clear playing field because nobody else wants to do that work. Nobody else wants to get their shoes dirty. And that's what we're trying to do is open up these doors so that more Black people, more Black women can start to solve their own problems. Because yes, I'm solving hair care right now, but we have so many other problems, from dermatological issues to other medical issues to menopausal issues to, I mean, you name it. There's so many problems that we need to be able to solve for ourselves, because if we don't solve it, nobody else will. And you're right, we have raised over we've raised over $1.5 million in venture funding at this point. And so we're really proud of that. It's a drop in the bucket, as you guys know, in the venture space. But the space is very difficult for people of color, for Black people, for Black women to raise in. And so we're really trying to do this the way that it needs to be done, raise more money and get this product out.
I love that. And usually one of the first questions we ask is, you know, why do you work? What has propelled you to build not the shell company, but more or less build with the idea of others in mind?
Yeah, it's your prototypical founder story, right? I saw a problem. I had that problem. I looked around and everyone around me had that problem and nobody was solving. Nobody was solving it. So much so that initially, you know, the story goes, I'm watching Shark Tank one night and I see this woman. It's so cliche, right? But I'm watching Shark Tank and there's this woman, Tara. I can't think of her last name, but she designed the Sleep Styler. Very simple curler brand. And, you know, she came on the show and she said, you know, I made $1 million in 8 months post-launch. Simple product. And I said to myself, you know, this space is completely saturated with products for the majority. Where are the products for the minorities? And what would those products look like? And I literally sketched out a prototype on a notepad. And I went to the CVS the next day, and I went to the CVS and the Ace Hardware down the street, and got all the combs and brushes I could find. And I got all of the hinges and soldering irons and all the doodads I could find. And I went home and I literally, with my scissors and my duct tape, literally put together a very early stage prototype. I did not expect to be building this product. I was building a whole other product. I was building a real estate company at the time. But I knew that somebody had to solve it, right? We were struggling. I'm struggling. All of my friends are struggling. All of my coworkers are struggling. You know, historically, all of my teammates, I was an athlete, all of my teammate friends were struggling. I said, somebody's got to solve this. And so I actually got on a train from DC to New York a couple of times and met with as many executives in the beauty space as I could. One of those executives was Keenan Beasley. He's now the founder of Sunday to Sunday and a myriad of other Black women-focused brands. But at the time, he was a VP at L'Oreal. And he said to me, this is genius, but L'Oreal doesn't make these kinds of products. They acquire companies that make these kinds of products. You should make this product. And so I got back on the train. I went to DC and just started searching for engineers, and the whole thing has culminated in where we are today.
Wow. And often you see that in founders, especially people of color, women of color founders, there's a certain level of lived experience that often, because it's a lived experience, when you share it to a VC group that may not look like you, they may not understand how much this might plague a certain community and how, you know, certain communities are impelled to be able to spend that much money. When you look at Madam C.J. Walker, her rise to becoming one of the first Black women millionaires was based off of the fact that there are, you know, a middle class of Black people that have a need, especially around hair care product. So that's to right. Hear that you connected with a multi-billion-dollar company that was faced with that build or buy decision, they realized that buying something that is built and made for people that are often not the majority is the most profitable way towards scaling up a business. So yeah. I would love to understand, what does ritualist mean? Maybe not only to you, but you can share it to the users. How did you come up with that? A pretty fire name.
So ritualist, we spell it R-I-C-H-U-A-L-I-S-T. And basically what we're doing here is we're providing an experience, right? This process of detangling and conditioning and styling and maintaining your hair, it's every woman of color with natural hair's nightmare, right? Like, we dread it. We love our hair. We've come to love our aesthetic, which is so beautiful, but it's also really hard to get people to, you know, just be able to relax into this process, right? So we've got all of this beauty, but the logistics are still so, so terrible. And so really what we're trying to do is provide that rich experience that makes people say, ah, yes, wash day, it's finally here. I get to do this thing. I get to have a self-care moment, right? So when you go to our website, you'll see all of the brand colors are very soothing and calm. We offer a wash day playlist where folks can, you know, just relax while they're going through their wash day. We try to provide a different spin on wash day. Yes, it's about the product. Yes, the product does amazing things for one's routine. But as you guys know, when you're building a brand, it's about building out the vision and the feeling for that customer. We're trying to do that in as many ways as we can.
Absolutely. And mentioning again, over 1.5 million in funding, I'd love for you to share a little bit about those early stages of the business. As we know, it takes years to get from zero to that amount of money. Again, meeting with the L'Oreal executive and then taking that time back. So let's start on that train ride home from New York to DC. What went into building up a company like Ritualist?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing, if we, wow, take it back to that train ride, was probably massive disappointment, because I didn't expect for someone to say, go build this thing, right? How do I do that? I expected for somebody to just kind of take it off my hands and make the thing. And so it became this really overwhelming moment. Am I about to pivot my entire company? So at the time, you know, I had been building real estate in DC. I'd been, you know, buying single family homes, chopping them up into multi-units and putting them back on the market, renting them, and then eventually putting them back on the market. And I had to make a decision, right? It was very clear, just a couple of Google searches, this is not going to be cheap, right? I can either do one or the other. And I really had to make some decisions. And I don't know that I made that decision immediately. But what I can tell you is that I went home and I started passing this really rickety prototype past everyone that I knew, right? It was ugly. It had duct tape holding it together. I think there was a bobby pin or two in there. It was very ugly. But I passed it, you know, through all of my friends and said, look, this doesn't do X, Y, and Z yet, but if this could detangle your hair, and what if I could make it heat up a little bit and get your products really nice and warm? And what if I could make it glide through your hair more easily? Would you pay for this? And they just kept hearing, yes, 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 yeah, of course, yeah, totally. You got to build this. Oh my God, right? The response that I got was completely different than any response I had ever gotten with any other business venture, you know, and I've always had maybe a little smidge of entrepreneur in me throughout my life. So, you know, in law school, I launched a magazine that was supposed to be focused on Black talent in DC. As I mentioned, you know, I kind of launched this real estate enterprise. And so that vein had always been running through my career, and I had never seen the response to an idea the way that I saw a response here. And that was the real big kind of signal to me that there was something here. And I can't tell you exactly when I made that change. I came up with the idea in 2017, so it's been a very long road. But in 2018, I incorporated, actually, you know what, I can tell you, summer of 2017 is when I, you know, went to that Ace Hardware and went to that beauty supply store. And then by February of 2018, I had completely pivoted and had, you know, completely kind of focused on building the tech-enabled hardware. So it took about 6 months for me to really make the decision and make that leap. But I made that leap because of listening to customers and listening to their enthusiasm. In fact, every decision that we've made, the reason that we've been able to produce such a pristine product that provides so much value to its customers is because we've listened intently to our customers and we've made those changes and those iterations. It's been about 5 years of development, but we're so excited to finally get this product into customers' hands.
So the heated hair applicator and styler of what it is today, selling out on stores, wouldn't have been possible if you didn't put together that duct taped MVP.
That's right.
For people to see.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it all started with the ugliest prototype ever. Now, you know, I'm teaching classes on entrepreneurship, which just blows my mind. And I see, you know, folks all the time saying, well, you know, I need $1 million. I need $7 million to get started. And the reality is most of us, not all of us, but most of us can get started with a few hundred dollars at most, right? We can do a lot with a little. And the key to entrepreneurship, I believe, is figuring out how to do big things leanly.
It's amazing. Awesome. Thank you. I think even just within this like short moment, you've unpacked so many skills that for the people listening that have those four or five ideas that are on the back of the on the back burner, if there's one idea that you know with enough hard work, with you know even $150, even with some Google Cloud credits,
that's
you can
right.
put in the front of people.
That's right.
Big.
Mm-hmm. It is big, and sometimes it's not about winning, right? We forget that entrepreneurship is about learning. It's about the focus. It's about the process. Every entrepreneur that I know who has made it, right, who's had the big exit, all they can talk about is where we are now, right? All they want to talk about is, well, you know, when I was in my day, this is the moment when you're in it and you're failing and you're figuring things out and you're bringing something to market. And then that is the story. That's the big win, right? And so we have to keep remembering as entrepreneurs that it's not about getting to anybody's finish line, getting in it, getting into the process. That's the whole game.
Wow. I mean, we've had a bunch of interviews, and even what we see sometimes in the ecosystem is that, you know, what's your next win or what's your most recent win?
Yeah.
That focus on, you know, how good you are. That can be like a big deterrent for some people into becoming like a founder.
Yeah.
It's clear, you know, that with what you've done, you know, you feel like you've built enough kind of traction, mental traction. You've built enough progress to where it'd be just too crazy not to quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel that a lot. So prior to coming, you know, into entrepreneurship, I worked at a big law firm in DC. And when I left, I burned some bridges, right? Like left in a fury, right? Like really just fireworks everywhere. And I did that. Some of it was subconscious, but some of it was very conscious, right? Like I knew that if I was going to do this, I needed to not have a pathway back, right? It needed to not be easy for me to just jump back in. And having burned those bridges, and you know, let's be fair, they deserved to be burned. But the wonderful thing is that, you know, it kept me focused when things got hard. Sure, if I really wanted to, I could have gone back in that direction. But one, I didn't want to. And two, I knew that I had something big. There was a lot of upside that I still hadn't discovered in the path in front of me. So yeah, you know, this process is really beautiful. And I think those hard moments, they can really kind of make you question your path. But really severing your ties with some of those other options helps you keep going.
Absolutely. And amidst the fast, thank you for doing this while practicing and staying faithful to your Ramadan commitment, because I know a lot of it is being humble, bringing yourself back to the earth and having that mindfulness so that you can connect with the creator. So, this couldn't be a better time to talk about, you know, how staying humble can bring you to places you never imagined.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, this practice is just so beautiful any time of year and no matter what profession you are in. But being an entrepreneur and being in the midst of Ramadan and really getting back to your mission and your purpose and making sure that you're rightly aligned, it's a really beautiful process, and I'm very grateful for it.
Absolutely. So, Alair, feel free to jump in, but I think we really talked about the why, you know, why you're in this space, why you stayed committed to it. There's an Afrotech article where, you know, you shared you had to go through a number of roadblocks, whether it's personal health or whether it was turning down that real estate business, because like you said, you knew when there's a huge valley in front of you, sometimes the worst thing you can do is turn around and look back. So, could you share a little bit, any motivation about, you know, why sometimes taking that leap of faith in a world where there's so many distractions, what is the benefit of focus, especially when you're trying to build something?
I mean, it's everything, right? The entire game is just being able to jump back in. It's being able to get knocked down and being able to take that side road, right? We all know that moment where you have an investor meeting and they say, well, if you just do this, then I'll fund you, right? So you get distracted from your main mission. And of course, they don't end up funding you, right? You have to stay focused no matter what the distractions are. But I'll tell you, you know, you've asked me to elaborate on my why. And I'll say that along the way, you know, I've developed such incredible relationships with the women around me. And those women have not just been wonderful partners, but they've also been wonderful friends, right? And we share this mission. We share this mission of serving women and women of color in particular in a way the market refuses to. And I don't have to tell you guys, I probably don't have to tell your listeners how poorly funded all of those women are, particularly the Black women around me, right? So a lot of what keeps me going is feeling an obligation to put some points up on the board for Black women run companies, right? Every room I have ever been in tells me, even now that I have product that is made and produced, you can't do this. You're not going to be able to pull this off, right? They've been saying it from the very beginning. And so for me, it's important to establish that precedent. We are just kind of inching into the space and fighting for every foot of progress. And so to give up would be to lose a lot of ground for us. I'm one of something like maybe 200, not even, Black women to have been, you know, given this opportunity to build, to have raised over $1 million in funding. It's a huge privilege, but it's also a huge obligation. We've got to put points up on the board, right? We can't just take that money and do nothing with it. We've got to get ROI. So that's what keeps me in the game, right? I've developed such incredible relationships with the women around me. And in order for them to win, I've got to go as far as I can possibly go. In order for me to win, they've got to get in front of me and, you know, reach back and give me what they know and give me their contacts. So it's really, truly an ecosystem here.
Absolutely. I'd be sick if I didn't ask, like, could you share some of the Black women that are in your corner, some of the Black women that you look at for inspiration on this journey?
Where does one start? I'll start with Omi Bell of Black Girl Ventures. So my path into the space is a little differentiated, right? Because I didn't just kind of jump into being a founder. I started out as an ecosystem builder. I started out building ecosystems in DC and Virginia. I started with Startups Ignite. Then I went to Black Girl Ventures. And working at Black Girl Ventures gave me a lot of bona fides. I got my first peeks behind the curtain of VC, and I got to be that fly on the wall and hear how VCs think about different companies. We were launching pitch competitions. That was my job. And so I'm behind the scenes listening for the first time to how VCs think about this, right? And it put me in a position where, okay, I hear this term. What does this mean? I can go read the books, and the books make more sense and more content because I have more context around them. And then from there, from Black Girl Ventures, I went on to run the Veneta Project, which is a national 501c3. That focuses on the needs of women in tech. And so even there, I got an even deeper understanding of VC. And so I'm building simultaneously. I'm building my company, but I'm also running these ecosystems and I'm learning. And it's like, you know, what's the saying? Water hose to fire hose to mouth, right? You're just taking in so much information at once. And so, you know, Omi really kind of opened up the space to me. She actually fed me the opportunity with Veneta. She put me at the dinner that ended up getting me that position. That position completely changed the way that people thought about me, right? They didn't think of me as, you know, just a startup founder. They saw me as somewhat of a peer. And so my conversations were different. And I guarantee you, you know, raising that first 500K would have been impossible without people seeing me differently and without my conversation being different. I'm a Black woman raising for hardware and raising for hardware that's focused on the needs of people of color. That's an almost impossible set of circumstances to parse through. But I parsed through it in large part because of the platform that I was given, and Omi was a big part of that. So Omi was a big part of that. I'd say Khadija ran the Nile list, and the Nile list was eventually acquired by our friend Sean Diddy Combs. So I'm really interested. I should actually text her and see how things are going. But she recently stepped away from her position at the Nile list, and she's doing her own thing. And, you know, she's really interesting because she had such a quick trajectory to exit. You know, so many of us, I mean, we're doing at least 7 years, but for a lot of Black founders, this looks like more of a 10 to 15 year journey to exit. And she got that exit really quickly and really early. And so she's a wealth of knowledge for a lot of us who are starting to have those acquisition conversations. Who else? There's Nasa, Shelley, and Sally Hama over at Carpe Diem. Carpe Diem is a dating website that is focused on Black relationships and the needs of Black women in particular. My relationship with them is really special because we went to law school together. We were in the same class. And we weren't actually super close in law school. It wasn't until we found out that we were both running companies that we just kind of, you know, coalesced and we've been pretty inseparable since. So, you know, they've been a big part of my journey. Christina Williams at Zim, Mandela Schumacher Hodge Dixon from Founder Gym, and then All Raise, Paige from Founder Gym and All Raise. I mean, I could go on and on and on. There's so many people who have been so influential in this journey. But what's clear to me is that all of these women, listen, everybody in the venture and startup space is committed to their mission, but Black women are committed on a different level. And so it's just really a beautiful thing being in communion with these mission-driven people while you're building your company.
Absolutely. I mean, if you want to go far, I don't know, if you want to go fast, you know, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. So That's right. Thank you.
Yeah, for
thank
sure.
you for sharing.
Yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity and platform to share.
Yeah, anytime. No, I can't imagine someone not getting some good advice from this, good tips from this.
Big guys. And I resonate a lot with your kind of upbringing in terms of your introduction to entrepreneurship and like VC side of things, because mine and my co-founders as well, within Upfront Capitals, we started with the Baltimore Angels. So we got that introduction to learning about all of that back in their heyday before they kind of took that downturn to what they're doing now, which is, I don't know what, but back in that time, right, similar to your experience with Black Girl Ventures, we were helping put on the pitch competitions that they would have, vet entrepreneurs, talk to them, really understand their products, you know, give them the hope that they need to keep continue going. All of that stuff that we don't necessarily get as Black founders, but, you know, I digress. But, you know, despite this, you've been able to kind of, you know, create your company and create your product to, you know, such a level that not many people get to reach. And how, I guess, to your point, right, not many people document the in-between of what it takes to really figure out and find out how what you need to do to get to that next level, right, to get to that exit, to get to the billion-dollar unicorn that you want to be and list on the NASDAQ if you want, right? How has it been for you producing and manufacturing these products? What has that process been like since, you know, you figured out that this was the path that you needed to do once the L'Oreal exec told you, hey, build this and maybe we might come and buy it someday? What has that been like for you?
Yeah, it's been tough. It's been very tough. It's been a winding road. Okay, so I post-law school, I graduate law school just after the recession, right? And nobody's hiring, which is fine with me because I don't actually want to practice anyway. And I get an opportunity to do some business development work in China, in Beijing, with a firm that essentially does business development with Chinese companies, with international companies on behalf of American firms. While I'm there, before I leave, there's a man Donovan England, who's now a huge designer. Donovan, my dad, was getting a suit designed by Donovan. This is when he was still working out of his house. My dad takes me over to Donovan's house, and you know he knows that he spent some time in China, and I'm obviously on my way to China. And he asks him, "Hey, can you give my daughter some pointers?" And so Donovan very graciously sits me down for, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes, and gives me all the tea. But what he kept saying over and over again was, if you go over there and you figure out manufacturing, the world is your oyster. What in the world do you mean by that, Donovan? I don't know what that means. I don't know what any of these words mean. And he's telling me all these things and he's naming all these regions and I'm just kind of flabbergasted. I don't get it. But sure enough, I get over to China and those words ring. And I see manufacturing this and manufacturing that. And I just start getting on buses and I start getting on, you know, trains and going to rural areas and semi-rural areas in China. And you got to picture this. I'm at the time, I'm 26 and I've got this huge head of hair, right? Like my hair was literally like out to here. And I'm the only black person that anyone has ever seen in 95 of the spaces that I've been in, right?
I could imagine all the eyes. I
Yeah.
hear.
So many eyes. I barely speak Chinese, at least when I get there. I barely speak Mandarin, but I learn it. And I learn enough for me to get around. And I learn enough to, like I said, navigate, get on trains, get on buses, and find my way to these manufacturing facilities. And most of these manufacturing facilities would have a English speaking person, at least one English speaking person who would just kind of interface with any foreigner. And I would find that person and I would just ask them questions, ask them questions, ask them questions. And those questions would lead to more questions, and those questions would lead to other site visits. And eventually, listen, I didn't leave China with a full-blown understanding of the manufacturing sphere. But I did leave China with enough of the puzzle to be able to piece this thing together, right? So fast forward, I leave China, I get called up to the Obama campaign. This was 2012. I get called up to the Obama campaign, I work the campaign, I come back to DC. You know, I thought I was going to end up in the White House. Don't end up in the White House. You know, end up in big law. I'm miserable. I leave. I start real estate. We finally pivot over to hardware, to beauty. And I don't know what I'm doing, right? It started with a Google search. And I think, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I have no idea what these things are, right? But then I go to my phone book and I've got a couple of people who I've made really good relationships with, right? There's one guy, Frank, who I used to give English lessons to, who was in the manufacturing space. So I call Frank. I say, "Frank, I've got this idea. What do I do?" And so Frank says, "Well, you know, you just do this, 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 this." And I'm hearing these words that I've been hearing, you know, since I when I was in China, right? I start hearing all of these terms that didn't really make sense to me, and now they're starting to click. Mechanical engineer and industrial design and Shenzhen region for tech-enabled products. Okay. Now I understand what all these things mean, right? And so the dots start to connect. And eventually I ended up using a team, not through Frank. I end up using a team, a Chinese team that was headed by a couple of French guys, right? And that was really key because that Chinese team was able to economize this process so that I could get some early stage prototypes done cheaply. But that French, those French leads were able to build in some of the cultural competence that wouldn't have been there otherwise, right? So, for example, I have really curly, curly, kinky hair. And one of the guys, Eve, who did some of our first prototypes, Eve had had a black girlfriend back in France. That was really key. He didn't know everything and he didn't necessarily have my texture of hair, but he understood some of the variables that I was not competent enough to communicate around, right? And
That's
so,
very key. That's
yes.
How much of that is luck? Because like, how could you have pictured finding that out instead of like, were you originally before then, were you struggling to communicate how your hair was, or it was it just like first day, I have a black girlfriend, can I help you with this? Like, how does that work?
No. So I didn't struggle communicating because I didn't even understand the pieces of the puzzle that I wasn't competent enough to discuss, right? Does that make
Gotcha.
sense? Right? Like there were so many blinders. I didn't know anything about engineering. I didn't know anything about ergonomics and industrial design. I didn't know anything about all of the nuances necessary to bring a product like this to fruition. And quite frankly, neither did Eve, right? So I don't remember when he mentioned it, but eventually, Eve mentioned that he had this black girlfriend, and it just made a lot of a lot of the kind of cultural bits that I hadn't gotten enough erudition around, maybe, to be able to even parse out, right? Like I wasn't thinking about things like hair density versus hair length, right? I'm thinking about length. I wasn't thinking about density, but of course, density completely changes the volume of product that we need in our pods. I wasn't thinking about things like a salonist ergonomics versus a at-home user's, a at-home DIYer's ergonomics. There's so many pieces of the puzzle that I just hadn't parsed out yet. And Eve was that first step in me being able to start to sort out, okay, this is the language of this space. So, I'm a lawyer by training. I never practiced. I went straight into politics. That language, it's a very specific kind of language. It's a very specific kind of logic. Engineering language and logic is completely different. And so I had to learn how to think in a different way. And so, what we basically did, I sold, my multi-unit. I sold that off. I used those proceeds to develop some initial prototypes. And when I developed those initial prototypes, we knew that we weren't going to have a commercial ready product, right? The goal was to figure out those big pieces of the puzzle, right? That were going to cost a lot of money if I had them engineered in the States, right? So some of the things that we were trying to figure out was what's the best mechanism for heating this product? What's the best mechanism for dispersing the product into the bristles? What's the best mechanism? Should it be one-sided? Should it be two-sided, right? What's going to be the best way to do this? And so we were able to take some of those really big variables and narrow down the field, right? So what I spent with that Chinese slash French team, just wild guess without going back and kind of, running the numbers, it's probably like a fifth of what I spent in the US. Right. And so if I had taken all of those engineering hours that it took to figure out those big pieces of the puzzle and multiplied them by, say, five, this would have been a much, much, much more expensive process than it was. Basically, what we did is we figured out the big pieces of the puzzle. And then I was able to go to investors with a prototype, a working prototype. Was it perfect? No. Did we make insane changes to it between that stage and where we are now? Absolutely. But I was able to go to investors and say, hey, look, I've shot this video with users. I've gotten user feedback. I've taken it to some pitch competitions. I was able to show traction, even if it was very, very, very early traction, right? And with that, I had investors start to bite. Now, those investors sent me on one of those distracting, Odyssey quests. They said to me, okay, so you've got a product. That's great. But we need to know whether or not you can market that product. We need you to raise a brand, raise a whole other brand, right? So I raised a brand. I raised the Most. So if you go to the Most Curls, it's still active, completely functional brand today. Where we did very low cost versions of what we do at Ritualist now. So we took some very low cost mechanical detangling tools. We changed them. We tweaked them ever so slightly for the needs of the highly textured hair care community. And we put together an incredible brand. And I mean, like I said, to this day, that brand is still functioning.